Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Welcome back to All of It. I'm Matt Katz, filling in for Allison Stewart. Now, an investigative true crime podcast that looks at the disappearance of a transgender sex worker in Toronto and how blind spots in the police investigations reflect a much larger systemic failure to protect Toronto's LGBTQ community. Season 2 of The Village, a series put out through CBC's Uncover podcast, centers the story of Alora Wells. She had stopped posting to her Facebook in July 2017. When her friends started worrying that they hadn't heard from her, they called a local police precinct to see if she was in jail, and they were told that she had indeed been arrested. But in reality, she hadn't. That was July. Partially because of this mistake, Alora wasn't reported missing until November. That's when a sample of her father's DNA pinged a match to the remains of a trans woman found in a ravine in Toronto back in August. In the months between her disappearance and the identification of her body, the police demonstrated to advocates that they didn't consider the case of a murdered, unhoused trans sex worker to be a priority. So it wasn't cops canvassing the neighborhoods and following up on leads. It was advocates who aid sex workers and LGBTQ people who are out there looking for answers. Here's Monica Forrester, a friend of Alora's and a sex work activist, talking about how the community was taking in Alora's death.
This is concerning to not only the participants that we serve at Maggie's, but to the community, that the community was not notified about this body. We still have a killer on the loose. I understand there's a lot of work to finding out who this person is, but there was no consultation within the community, and we had to do our own work. And thanks to the woman that came forward when they seen Alora's picture on the news to tell us there was a body found.
Joining me now to talk about his reporting on this is Justin Ling, a freelance journalist and host of The Village podcast. Justin, thanks so much for being here.
Hey, thanks for having me.
It's our pleasure. So season two of The Village, or the two episodes that are out so far, which I've listened to, was amazed by them. It covers the circumstances around the death of Alora Wells, and the case is still unsolved. So let's start there. What do we know about how Alora Wells was killed, and what does the actual physical evidence in this case consist of so far?
Right. So, you know, we know she died violently. We don't know too much beyond that. As a part of our research, we get a hold of her death investigation, which includes her coroner's report. We know she sustained really serious injuries in the months before she died, and again, immediately before she died. Injuries that, you know, looked like she could have been hit, you know, quite severely and repeatedly. So she went through something clearly very traumatic. We knew, we've heard from her friends that her partner at the time was abusive. You know, that's something that Alora herself had relayed multiple times. And they were still together at the time of her death. So, you know, there's plenty here to suggest that foul play may have been involved, but it's not conclusive to this point. But, you know, part of the reason why the community is, you know, I think is and was so sort of frustrated and distraught by her death is that her body was found in the months after, you know, another man had disappeared from the gay village. It's something we deal with in the first season of our show. You know, there had been a serial killer stalking the village who ultimately killed 8 men. Alora's body was found in the midst of all of that. And yet there has never kind of been the same level of attention or scrutiny or questioning of what happened in her case, even though it really looks like a lot of the same police failures that were present in the investigation into those missing men were present in the investigation into her death.
Hmm. And tell us about season one for those who haven't had a chance to listen to yet of The Village. Tell us, first of all, about the place, what The Village is, and then what you focus season one on.
Yeah, so Toronto's gay village is, you know, one of the largest in the world, I think, without too much competition. You know, it certainly rivals New York and several other cities in terms of, you know, the population, the number of bars, the culture there. And you know, it's a space that's supposed to be, you know, safe. Particularly, it's a place that welcomes many queer refugees from around the world. And in fact, a number of men who had fled war zones, who had fled civil strife abroad, had come to Toronto and had started disappearing, going back to about 2010. 8 men vanished off the streets between 2010 and 2017, and there was really no alarm system like we may have expected. You know, this is supposed to be a community. This is supposed to be a space where people can't just vanish, where people are looked after, where people are accounted for. And yet these 8 men disappeared, and I think really what we get at in the first season is that they never got the attention they deserved. There was never an adequate investigation. The one task force that was dispatched to handle some of those cases was disbanded far too early. They actually at one point stop and question and bring into the station the guy who they would later arrest for these 8 murders. And his story was full of lies and holes, and police didn't catch it. So there's a whole bunch wrapped up in that. I mean, there's a, you know, a mistrust, a distrust, a misunderstanding of racialized people, of refugees, a lack of cultural comprehension of queer people, and frankly, just an animosity between the community and the police that goes back decades, and that it should be very familiar for really any queer person in North America, whether you're in Toronto, Montreal, Chicago, New York, LA, San Francisco, you name it. These sort of things tend to repeat themselves. You tend to see an effort to sort of over-police these communities, to impose some sort of, you know, moral standard on them that isn't present elsewhere. And then simultaneously or around the same time, an uptick of violence that just does not get solved. So we sort of try and lay that out, you know, with Toronto as sort of a microcosm for a lot of those issues.
It's really interesting. If you're just joining us, this is Matt Katz. I'm filling in for Allison Stewart, and we're talking to Justin Ling, journalist and host of the Village podcast. You know, it does seem to me that this case and the over-policing of these communities in the 70s, and then this sort of lack of care about the disappearance of someone who maybe the police see as living on the margins, is this happened in Toronto, but it really could happen in any gay neighborhood in the world, right? I mean, there must have been other cases, similar cases, missing people, over-policing that you've read about and learned about elsewhere beyond Canada?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, we've spent a fair bit of time digging into other cities around North America and around the world, honestly, where these same sort of things, these same sort of trends were present. I mean, you can look at San Francisco. You know, there was a serial killer operating throughout the 60s and 70s who earned the sort of gross nickname of the Doodler, who's responsible for as many as half a dozen murders, who was going and picking up these targets just as the San Francisco Police Department was busting bars and harassing men and bothering trans people on the street at a time when the relationship was at probably its worst, was the exact moment you had the serial killer operating. I can point you to a number of cities, from Minneapolis to even rural Texas to New York, obviously, multiple times through multiple decades. Montreal, through the 90s, went through something incredibly similar. In the first season of the show, we go to Detroit and basically find that Toronto and Detroit went through roughly the same trend of this, you know, incredible over-policing and this simultaneous under-protection around the same time. And really, the point of the new season is to underscore the degree to which this is not a problem in the past tense. This is a problem that's ongoing, and predominantly it's affecting the trans community. You know, last year, 2020, was the worst year on record in America for violence against trans people. 44 trans people were murdered. You've seen a lack of seriousness, frankly, by governments across the U.S. about this problem. You've seen, even amidst this uptick in violence, a concerted effort to take away trans people's rights. You've seen an effort to go after sex workers. You've seen an effort to criminalize providing health care to trans people. You've seen an attempt to push them out of sports, to forbid them from public bathrooms. There is an assault going on the rights of trans people in America, and to a lesser extent, Canada, but certainly to a large degree in Hungary and Georgia and throughout Europe. And it's coming with a significant increase in homicide, assault, and sexual assault. And our politicians either seem totally unaware of that linkage, or they don't seem to care, totally frankly. They seem okay with the violence impacting these communities. So a big part of what we want to do in season two is lay out how those sort of debates around the very existence of trans people and attempts to kind of push them back into the closet can really, you know, tie in with a significant increase in violence against them.
Yeah. Well, let's dig into some of the details of season two of The Village right now. A lot of the story is told from the recollections of Monica Forrester, transgender and sex work activist who had been friends with Allura. What did those months after Allura's disappearance look like for Monica?
It was incredibly difficult. I mean, Monica, as you're going to hear as the season goes on, hasn't lost one or two people from the community. She's lost many friends, colleagues, you know, acquaintances to violence. So when Allura disappears, I think her fight or flight instinct sort of kicks in. You know, initially, like you mentioned off the top, they thought she was in jail, you know, basically criminalized again for being a sex worker or for being homeless. And when they realize that she's not, in fact, incarcerated, they get incredibly anxious. You know, they start banging down doors. They start searching the ravine where she lived. They start demanding answers from the cops. And it's then they find out that there had been a trans woman in the morgue for months. And the Toronto police didn't tell anybody. And I can't stress this enough. They didn't tell anybody. They found a body, possibly as the victim of a homicide, didn't go to the media, didn't put out a public release, didn't go to the community, didn't go to sex workers. They just kept it quiet. And upon learning that, Monica understandably gets furious. She described it. She goes on the warpath. And she really doesn't stop until, you know, obviously Toronto police acknowledge that it's Allura, but also until they acknowledge their failure. And she's still pushing. You can hear her in the show. She's still pushing for answers. And as we go through the season, you're going to hear and understand just how negligent this investigation was. And you're going to understand, frankly, just how little concern or care police can give trans people.
We're going to play a clip. This is a bit of Forrester talking about Monica Forrester, the friend of Allura's, and she's talking about the first time they tried to file a missing persons report about Allura.
Then the police says, "Oh, we know Allura. You know, here's a number. She's probably not missing because she was homeless. She's probably anywhere." So he was really disturbed that they wouldn't take a police report immediately, but give him a number to call.
What is the deal with police departments and their handling of cases like this? Is it that there's just out and out bigotry against people in the LGBTQ community? Is it the fact that they just see people who don't have homes, who are involved in sex work, who use drugs as people not whose lives aren't worth looking into if their lives are lost? What do you make of the way police departments handle such cases?
Frankly, if it was out-and-out bigotry, if it was just really latent homophobia or transphobia or discrimination, it would be easier to fix, right? You know, it's sort of the bad apple theory of policing. You'd fire the bad ones. But the reality is, it's not a case of individual officers being horrible. It's about a system that consistently does not do this well. In the first season of the show, you hear about how when men go missing and are reported to the police, they keep insisting, well, maybe these guys went back home, right? These are refugees from the civil war in Afghanistan, the refugees from Sri Lanka. And I would be on the phone with these cops when these men were still missing, and I would hear from them, well, you know, he was in the closet, he was gay, he didn't want to tell his wife, he probably went back home to Afghanistan. The lack of cultural competency, the lack of understanding, the lack of any sort of recognition of the realities of the queer community leads you to statements like that. They're also, you know, those lack of competencies lead you to say things like, well, Allura's always missing, she's probably fine, right? It is a fundamental disconnect between the people who police our cities and the people who they're policing. And this has been a reality for decades. Every single city in North America knows this very well. If you are a sex worker, if you use drugs, if you're homeless, if you're transgender, if you're queer, if you're black, if you're Latino, you know what it's like to be policed by people who don't understand you. And it's not just a symbolic difference. It is literally a difference that can mean police don't take your case seriously. And there are so many other things wrapped up in that. And again, as the season goes on, we're going to pull apart some of those things. You're going to hear how sex workers have always gotten the short end of the stick when it comes to policing, how they've not only been failed by police, but how they've often been harassed and marginalized by police, how politicians have written laws that put sex workers in the shadow and make them vulnerable. You're going to hear how the push against, you know, basic protections for trans people and the push against recognizing violence against trans people as a hate crime, how that fed into a systemic and sort of high level indifference to the realities trans people face, and ultimately push them into things like sex work, push them into homelessness, push them into drug use. So, you know, these things are all really tightly connected. And again, it would be so simple to fix if it was just a case of a handful of people who needed sensitivity training. But it is so much more structural than that. And until we start confronting this, you know, we're never going to do better the next time someone like Alora goes missing. And we actually, you know, in episode 3, we talk about another trans woman who died almost 2 decades ago, whose death remains similarly unsolved. You know, a woman who was an activist, a pillar of her community, who, again, was also a friend of Monica Forrester, who was killed in her apartment and whose death remains unsolved to this day. So this is a problem that keeps repeating itself. No matter how many times we say we understand the issue and we want to fix it, then no matter how many times we talk about hiring liaisons for the community, no matter how many times we talk about improving cultural competency and improving education and training, things don't seem to get significantly better when it comes to policing.
Justin, before I let you go, I'm curious why you are drawn to these stories. You seem to want to highlight underreported stories and bring to the fore names of people who aren't known beyond their own communities. Why do you tell these stories?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question. Yeah, I think to some degree, it's a matter of if I don't do it, who else will? You know, when I first started writing about the missing men from the village, it was 2015, and many of them had been missing for 3, 4, 5 years, and everybody had forgotten. The police investigation was shut down. The media wasn't asking these questions anymore. The city didn't seem to care. And it just struck me that if I didn't start writing about it and calling up these cops and reaching out to their friends and family and trying to get some sort of answers, then probably no one was going to. And, you know, I think this is my community as well. And it's really frustrating to watch governments and police and mayors and politicians go raise the pride flag every year and congratulate themselves on a job well done, even as they're continuing to enable this sort of systemic failure, even as they're continuing to criminalize, you know, queer people in the community, even as they're continuing to make trans people's lives difficult. So it really comes down to a level of frustration that I think I have that, you know, I don't always see reflected in the media more broadly.
Well, thank you for telling these stories, Justin. I've been speaking with Justin Ling, host of the CBC podcast Uncover the Village. Season 2 is out now, and the 3rd episode drops tomorrow. Thanks so much, Justin. Thanks for coming on All of It.
Thanks for having me.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.